to turn the thing. I had a ham 2 up there one time, but it sort of started to get beat up, so I bought the tail twister. A little costly size, but I think it looks like a little bit more of a sturdy piece of equipment, Dick, over.
And have you done anything to balance it wind-wise? Or does the antenna have a little bit of difficulty turning on a really high windy day? In other words, it tries to aim itself downwind like many other antennas. Go ahead.
Testing 2 DKJ.
DKJ, I believe it is. The beam, no, it's not with this rotor. This rotor's got tremendous amount of watts and torque. And all. I could turn it in any wind, and it doesn't move. That tower, that's a heavy piece of, you know, steel. That's a big steel for commercial power. It's guiding everything the way it is. I overfit it, you know. I've got a couple thousand pounds of concrete right in the base section of that tower. And then the guy wires are all single steel, 3/8 guy wired and everything. So I know I went through a lot of extra work. And I can see the rotor sits down into the tower about 3 feet down from the top. It's a top bearing that's a bronze bearing up on top. Then it sits on another bearing that's a rear truck bearing, a large rear truck bearing. And the mast is a 2 3/4 mast that weighs a ton. That mast weighed in at over 200, about 450 pounds of mast. Or the mast is approximately, I think, about 10 foot. Yes, a 10 foot mast, a heavy wall mast. So it weighed a ton. That's why you have to have really a sturdy installation to support this kind of weight with that beam over.
Wow. And you've been using that for quite a few years. I get the impression it's like you've been using that for something like 20 years. Is that true, Mel?
A lot more than that. At this location alone, it's 30 years. I moved it from another location. So at this location, it's the 70s. So it's like I say, gone through a lot of bad, you know, storms and things right here off the ocean, 350 feet to my south, is the Atlantic Ocean. So, and this thing really, you know, there's no blockage here. This is the highest thing in the area at 85 feet. The highest, anything below it is no more than about 30. Some of the peaks and roofs get about 35 feet thick over.
When you said 85 feet, do you mean 85 feet above sea level or above ground? How tall is the tower that's mounted on?
85 feet. I don't know where the sea level is here. I guess I'm at sea level sometimes. Sometimes I once saw it. I was below sea level. I once saw the ocean actually come up the street here. She said bay. And the ocean here on the corner met each other, and there was on the street, there was enough seawater coming up, and it started to creep up the driveway. It came right up to my door within a couple of inches of my door. I almost had it. Telling you should have seen the damage to some of these houses that have the garages under the basement, you know, in the underneath the house. And the seawater just rolled over right into those houses. And, oh, geez, the damage from seawater is the worst. I just can't believe what seawater can do when it gets into a house that's over.
82HWW, a question for Mal, please.
Hey, you're right after Robert. And lucky for you that you're a little higher up there on Dover Street than some of the people to your south. Robert, KC2DKJ, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thanks, Dick. Off the whole topic you're on, quick question, since I moved into Amityville here, I'm wondering if anybody has one of those frequency guides or books. I'm looking for the frequency for North Amityville Fire Department, Amityville. I have to live right across the street now from North Amityville Fire Department. But I called them over there and asked the guys over there, know nothing about radio equipment, they just know how to pick up the microphone, get in the truck, and go to the fire. So I was wondering if anybody had one of those listings.
There is a website that has that. I don't know how to get to that website right now. Of all the people on frequency, does anyone know the way you get to the website that lists all the frequencies of the local fire, police, emergency services, and so on? I think some of the scanner clubs also collect that information. Anybody with any information, give it to me right now.
Demetroy White. The best thing you might try is just going on Google and put wireless scanner information. And it'll probably come up with a couple of hits, quite a few hits very quickly as far as what he's looking for. I can tell him offhand the fire dispatch is out on 4646, and I have a secondary low band frequency of 4634. At least I know those two. Most likely they're probably almost always using UHF after the initial alarm goes out. Most of these fire departments now are going to their own private UHF repeater systems to talk fire ground once the alarm goes out. That's any help. If you go to the, like I said, try Google and put low amount of scanner information in, you'll probably come up with a whole mess of different websites. There's one force.org or force something like that. Fourdice.org, I think, is the one that primarily will give you most of the information for Long Island, the immediate metropolitan area, if that's any help. WHORY.
Joe, one of the things I should tell you is your audio is very hot. You're banging into the sides of the repeater. And so some of your words, when you talk loud, come out a little bit distorted. But by way of Google search, you will find it, Robert. And if you don't, come back and we'll try a little harder. Howie, WB2HWW, go ahead with your question or comment. And as I remember, Howie, your audio the last time was also a little hot.
I'm going to clear out, guys. Thanks a lot. That second website, quickly, that you mentioned, for something or other, yeah, you were distorted, but I got Long Island Scanner Info. We'll try that. And that other site, please, then I'm going to clear out. I hope I'm not double.
Yeah, Joe, try to give that to us again a little bit lighter. It was so distorted that we didn't hear it.
Okay, Dick. First of all, Dick, I'm coming into you on the IRLP, all right? I'm attached to the same reflector channel. You're attached to your Sheldon repeater and your repeater in Glen Oaks. So I don't know how your levels are balanced in, but I know I'm balanced on the IRLP both ways. I do know that. I think it's called Fordyce, Fordyce. I think that's how it's spelled, .org. I think that's the main one you're going to come up when you put in Long Island Scanner information. Oh, just Long Island Scanner listening might even be better on Google. That's probably going to be the first one you're going to come up with. They just look for the different pages of the stuff the guy's got on there, and you're going to most likely find the primary two frequencies like I told you about, and you'll find probably the secondary UHF frequencies that they use also. Is this audio a little better as I back off the radio as far as closeness to the Dick?
That's a lot better. I listened to you on 375, and you're a little bit lower in volume than you are at 85, and sounds good. Okay, what do you think Fordyce stands for? Go ahead.
I do not have a...
I think you said you do not have a clue. But it got chopped out. Okay. Howie, HWW, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Thanks, guys. I'll clear out of here. KC2DKJ.
Dick, no, Dick, by the way, the level on 85 have to be said correctly. Andy knows about it. I'm said correctly, and I'm just backed off the mic. No, I got a question for Mel. Mel, I every couple of weeks go out to Brooklyn. I have dinner with a couple of faculty from Pratt, and we have it over at Emmons Avenue at a place called El Greco's, 1821 Emmons, and she said Bay Road. Is that in your neighborhood?
Roger, Roger. The other side of Chief said Bay Street, Greco's Diner. And I guess you go to over.
I know it's off topic, but you were talking about how far you are. I go there about every twice a month to meet a couple of professors from Pratt, one engineering professor. I don't know if y'all know him, Professor Levin. We always talk about politics and engineering and everything else. And by the way, Dick, just to bring you up to date, Pratt now has a course on a basic electricity and electronics for our students to take them from basic DC right up to interfacing with microprocessors. Just a smattering, one semester course. just to let you know. Let me roll it over to Mel. But that's right, Mel. I come over there, so I don't know how far I'm from you, but you're on the other side of the bay. I didn't realize that. Go ahead.
You have a little bit of altitude there, you know, there's a lot of trees and things, but if, yeah, from that side of the bay, if you get up, one of the buildings, second or third floor, and you look out directly south, you'll see the tower. So it's directly, just almost directly north of me. Let's see, it's actually north and one block, slightly, half a block west. That's Greco's Diner. Yeah, I've eaten there many times, good place for meetings and all, nice place, so been there many times, Howie, over.
I get there about 10:30, and we don't get out of here about 2 o'clock. Been going on for the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years. Same set of guys. Guys and gals. So that's about it. All right, I'll...
Okay, sounds like how we did finish that, transmission. I think we've answered your first piece of mail. And it's your choice if you want to go to a second one, please. Mel, K2LIW. I'm giving you some more letters to your call letters.
They got rid of the entire engineering building. What a sad day, Dick.
Yeah, I'm a little bit sorry to hear that. You got rid of the main engineering building. Did that become a building housing development and also the athletic field? Did that become part of a building development also, Howie?
They didn't tear down the building. They just went in there and redid it all. It had studios, you know, for artists and stuff like that. Now, they just went in and redid it. The building's still physically there. It's still physically there. And across from the building, obviously, you still have the, where the generator is, you know, the plant. That was always a nice place to go look at all the meters and just stand there and watch that thing turn around. But they're not, from what I understand, there is no more DC at all anywhere on the campus. I don't know if you remember in that school, you had to watch out. If you plug something in, even as late as the 70s, if you plug something into a wall, you better make sure you want to plug in a transformer into a DC outlet. And by the way, they took the library, just so you know this, the library is underground. They actually did a lot of work. So the library now has a couple floors underground. Over to you, Dick.
The library has a couple of floors underground. How about that? And yes, that those three or four DC generators that were in that courtyard midway between the architecture building and in the direction toward the engineering building, that was a fun place to go visit. I think you're saying those machines no longer turn, and that was the last holdout in New York City, to my knowledge, for DC power generation. I think you're telling me that has been closed down. I believe that ran only the engineering building. Is that true? Go ahead.
I think they still turn. But I don't think they're really powering anything. I think they're still turning it, but I think they're still providing some steam. But Con Ed now gives all the electricity to the whole school. There is no more DC anywhere on the campus.
Then it doesn't sound like there's much reason to turn those machines. The only reason those machines turned is to generate. If you're not generating, you can use the steam directly. You don't have to put them through those machines. Or am I mistaking here, Howie? Go ahead.
Well, next time I'm at dinner with these guys, I think they're telling it just because it's just a historic point of view for these statics. Go ahead.
Okay. So the last holdout for all of New York City of Edison-type DC generation was Epcot Institute. And so maybe for historic reasons, they're keeping it running. Even though it's not doing anything. Sounds like fun. Mel? What's the next thing you got in your mailbag? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Apropos to that, Brooklyn Tech, my old school, is also on a chopping block, I understand. They already cut back quite a bit on the faculty and the the enrollment, and now they the talk that they may close the building up and open up a smaller annex near the New Atlantic Yard, put another school in there and sell the building off as a condo or something, God not say so. This is give you a this is just a, basically what's happening in this country as we'll discuss engineering, mathematics, and sciences. This is, forget about it, this will be the whole night on it, not worth dwelling on this anymore. Let me, I'm reading off another, oh, here's one, I don't know if I should read this. I know Rich is on frequency and I hate reading. I bought a commercial quad and I've had year in and year out problems of servicing everything. I talked to the manufacturer and they said that something I never knew that they should have cautioned me on, that a quad does need maintenance. Can you give me any suggestions on how I can brace the quad, make it so that the wires don't break easily? Is there way anything that you guys have come up with that can help me with my dilemma? Because I am tired of going up there and repairing the quad every year. I don't know why. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have read that, Dick, over.
No, I think it's appropriate, Mel. The good news about the quad is it's probably the lowest wind load, reasonably high performance antenna that exists. That's the good news. The bad news is that the way the wire waves in the wind means that at the four corners, it's extremely vulnerable to metal fatigue. I'd like to believe that some smart mechanical engineer has found some way of doing strain relief in the four corners so you don't get metal fatigue in those areas. I guess it's also possible that a smart person could take string and tie it to the center of each one of the four pieces of flat wire that make up the four corners of the cubicle quad, and with string he could make a damping mechanism to stop it from swaying in the breeze. The string would have to be a carefully chosen string that has ultraviolet, that can survive the outdoor ultraviolet and ice in the wintertime and wind and rain and everything else, sun exposure and so on. So I know there are ways that a cubicle quad could be improved and designed by a smart mechanical engineer. But to take many of the currently available designs, you're going to have to accept the fact that they do have some built-in failure mechanisms. The one that Rich is going to buy, which I think is a pretty high-class one, if Rich is on frequency, he can tell us, well, Mel, do you happen to know, have they done anything to create strain relief at the four corners? Because that's where I think one of the big failure mechanisms exists. K2KEY, with a little delay in case Rich is in there, and 2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I don't hear Rick. Yeah, there was a number of articles that were published on how to improve the corners, how to brace up the spider better, and all kinds of things like that. And I assume that these commercial manufacturers of quads have taken that into consideration. But I've heard this quote before on the air. I've heard it from a few guys. Great antenna. But be prepared to do yearly servicing on it, tightening up things and all. It seems to be a common problem with them, of them really needing some maintenance, maybe no more than sometimes simple maintenance of just tightening things up. But I've heard this a number of times, Dick, over.
Okay. So if you're not willing to either buy a brand that has taken these corrective measures, or if you're not willing to apply corrective measures yourself, you're going to get failure with the conventional old-fashioned design of a cubicle quad. And to expect otherwise is similar to a guy who blows a fuse somewhere in a circuit and just keeps replacing fuses. If you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. So somebody's going to have to make a change. Right now, I guess, would you happen to remember who published an article for an improvement? Was it in Ham Radio Magazine or QTC or CQ or QST. Do you happen to know where and when approximately somebody published an article with some basic information as to what journal we could go to an index list on the Google and eventually get a copy of that article in his hands? Over to you, Mel.
K2KEY. Yeah, I think CQ, that guru that they had that did all the articles on for CQ, Doug DeMore, he used to cover a lot of those questions that he'd get in his mailbag at that time by old-fashioned mail, mail. And I think he covered it because he wrote for CQ, and I remember him doing an extensive series of articles on quads, and I think I have that because anything I ever see on antennas, I always rip out of magazines and put them in my antenna division, which is quite extensive. It's very possible that I'm sure the manufacturers of the quads have taken all this stuff into consideration, being that, you know, that's their product. But it's very possible that they're still going to crop up a certain number of troubles, Dick. Antennas are that way. That's it. Even with seeing things every so often, got to go up there, tighten up things. You've got to check it once in a while. Listen, it's at the mercy of the elements, and moving. There's movement. You can't stop completely, and chances are things are going to loosen up. So I mean, it's not unusual, like I say, to if you have any kind of antenna system, to scrutinize it once a year or so, take over.
Yeah, if you've done a real good job of choosing the right material, stainless steel for all of your metallic hardware, nuts and bolts and U-bolts and saddles, aluminum for most of the elements of the antenna, as little steel as possible unless it's very well galvanized, if you do all of the right things, you can, in theory, come up with a low-maintenance antenna system where you own the antenna and the antenna doesn't own you. If you're not careful, you can easily build systems where you've got to continuously do maintenance on it. As I say, then it owns you. You don't own it. I particularly worry about the fact that I've got galvanized steel towers, and I want to make sure that all of the hardware I put on it is either stainless or galvanized. You don't want to put rusting chunks of steel on your tower because the rust dripping down onto the galvanizing will literally eat up your galvanizing. The zinc of galvanizing is very sacrificial. If it sees local rust, it sacrifices itself to that rust. It tries to protect the rust. So you got to be careful. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I had that with the power here. It started to pit through, and did an extensive job on it a couple of years ago. It was a real killer. Starting up there, I sanded any rust spots out, wire brushed them out very clean, wiped them with some solvent, and then zinc chromated the whole thing and all, and then gave it a coat of aluminum paint over it. You just got to do these things here by the ocean. I know there's no way you're going to really get protection. It's very hard to neglect things here by the ocean. You should see what it does to any outside furniture, anything you got here close. Just get to it. All right. Shall we go on to one more?
Fire away.
Okay. Very good. Here's a good one, Vic. I picked up an amplifier that was built, I believe, in the 40s. It uses a single 813. Oh, I know this. And it was built as a single-band 80-meter amplifier. Can you tell me something about what I could put in as the variable condenser that is missing for plate tuning? Can you give me the approximate value of that? Do I remember this. This was making me laugh. I know the amplifier exactly. The approximate value of that that variable capacitor. You want to take the stick? I can tell you a whole story about this. Over.
That's probably a transmitting type 365 picofarad variable capacitor. Well, I bet you they made an even bigger one. Back to you, Mel. I don't know. You've used that. I haven't.
A little history. During World War II, they developed the 813 tube. They made so many of them that after World War II, through the 40s and into the 50s, they were selling these tubes for like 50 cents a piece. And that was my introduction to high-powered amplifier. And that tube was so rugged that you could load it up and actually watch the plate turn red without any problem, you know, any damage. So what happened was a lot of hams jumped on. In fact, my first high-powered amplifier was an 813, and I modulated AM modulation with a pair of 811. These were surplus parts to things to get the literally scrap weight. Now, this one he's talking about what they did. Okay. The 813 was the one that was a whole series of articles where this guy, they built, because you could buy the component surplus, in other words, you built amplifiers, not band switching amplifiers. Each amplifier was for another band, and you stacked them in a rack, and the only thing they had was a common power supply. They used one common power supply, and you just went. Actually, these guys, the way they did it, they actually went from one amplifier to another by unscrewing, you know, just pulling connectors out, pushing it into the next amplifier deck. So, I remember that whole series of articles that they had in USB. All the single-band amplifiers using 813s over.
Boy, I bet they were fun. And an 813, a single one, I think could pour out 500 watts. A pair of them, I believe, could produce a kilowatt of amplitude modulation. Is that true?
And the RF surface, they kept it, was called a half a gallon. The single 813, the pair 813, was a whole gallon at that time, which was the legal maximum, 1,000 watts. All right, now, basically, I'll give you a for instance. The plate load resistance, I remember very distinctly, of an 813 was approximately about 6,000 ohms. And the one on 80 meters, I know that one, I had that one, I built that one. Actually, it took a big chunk of things, and I condensed it down because for some reason when they built the bumper stem, maybe the bigger and the heavier, the better it was considered. Because they had a tank coil in there that was humongous. It looked like it was like for 5 kW, 10 kW, and all the components spread out and everything. So I condensed it down, made myself an amplifier. Now, as I said, the plate load resistance is about 6,000 ohms. And you figure that the tank coil was somewhere around a Q of 12. So that would yield you approximately a reactance of about 500 ohms necessary to tune that at 4 megahertz. That's the 80 meter version. So, let's see. So this 500 ohms, that's 4 megahertz. Oh, I haven't got my calculator. 500 ohms at 4 megahertz, what would that be approximately in PF, Dick? I have to get the calculator otherwise over.
I've got the calculator in my hand, and go ahead and talk for another 30 seconds, or for a minute. I'm grinding out an answer right now.
See, what Dick is doing basically, taking C equals, I'll give him a little theory now. What we did, we took the plate load resistance, which was 6,000 ohms, divided by the Q of the tank, which is around 12, and comes out to 500 ohms. But what Dick is doing now, he's taking C equals 10 to the 6th power divided by 6.28 times the frequency, which is 4 megahertz at the top of the band, times 500. And he's going to give us the value in 1 second. Now, the 813 was a grounded grid, ran in grounded grid. It was a tetrode running in what we call Class B operation. Okay, and now over to Mr. K2RIW for the value.
I'm still grinding. Stand by.
So, yes, the 813 still is a viable tube. Let me tell you, I have an amplifier. I haven't used it quite a number of years, lay in the closet, because I did start in when the ceramic tube came out. I fell in love with ceramic tubes, so I started out like Dick, building things with 4TX 250. And so that's what happened. I thought the more compact amplifiers, the 4CX250 were great. I built a mobile, a kilowatt rig, 700 watt rig with them, and so on and so forth, and graduated into stuff like 8877s. I used 3CX1500s, basically similar, and then 3CX800s, and so on and so forth. Those were the ceramics. But if we go back to World War II, these test roads were very popular. 813-125A, 304TL, and so on, for 811s, everything, the 811s, the triodes, very, very famous tubes, mostly used in modulation. Now, out there, in enough of these type amplifiers, in 811s from World War II.
Okay, I've got an answer, Mel. By the way, your switch is starting to give you a little bit of trouble. I don't believe the answer. You did say that the tube is 6,000 ohms. You did say with a Q of 10, it would be around 500 ohms on the capacitor reactance, the C1 capacitor, for the tuning control of the Pi network. 500 ohms, 4 megacycles, comes out to be just a skosh under 80 picofarad. So 80 picofarad is C1, and I'll bet you the C2 is going to be something closer to 365 picofarad. Back to you, Mel.
Now to remind me, yep, that was it, around 80. I remember 100, I had 100, remember exactly, it was 100, and the other one was the standard 350. Yep, that was it. Dick has it right. He took, again, 6,000 ohms of plate road resistance. I'll go over it again. The Q of the coil, in other words, that's the quality, the Q of the coil, is approximately, the U2, as a rule of thumb, was around 12. So he divided 6,000 by 12 and came out to about 500 ohms. Then substituted C equals 10 to the 6th power divided by 6.28 times the frequency, the top end of 80 meters, 4 megahertz, times the 500 ohms that we determined, and he came out with around 80 PF. So around 100 PF variable will work real well. I think that's the simplest way to explain it, Dick. Over.
Yes, it is, and I'm not sure, you'll have to tell me. I'm guessing the 813 tube took something like 2,500 volts on the plate, and when you are running that in a amplifier, before you add amplitude modulation, the plate is going to swing the full voltage in both directions, depending on whether there's a coupling capacitor off the plate. So you have to have a capacitor that's going to take at least 3,000 or 4,000 volts without arcing over. So you've got to choose a transmitting type capacitor that has big enough air spacing between those plates that it doesn't arc over. Isn't there around 2,500 volts on the plate of an 813 if you want full power output? Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY. All right. The 813 recommended in Class B linear operation was 2,000 volts on a plate, and let me remember, 400 volts. I have to stretch my memory. God, sick. This takes me back so many years. I haven't looked at that thing. It's in the Colossus. Every so often I look at the front panel of it and I laugh at it. 2,000 volts on the plate, and whoops. Oh, God, no, fuck. Yeah, someday I gotta figure a way to do something. Microphone. 2,000 volts on a plate, and a screen supply was 400 volts. This was typical of operation of a 813, and this was what everybody more or less was doing. The power supply were 2,000 volt supplies. They had that bleeder in there with the cap on it. A 100 watt bleeder. Those who I remember, I got a few of them around somewhere yet. In fact, I built a number of amplifiers after that using those 100 watt, what the heck was the name? Ohmike Corporation made those huge, humongous bleeders for military, and equipment. And that today, God knows what they would cost if you could find them. Big wire wound, hollow tube ceramic resistance. And that tap on there gave you the 400 volts. And what you did with that, they used a VR tube. OA2s and OB2s in series of numbers, and that was what we would call xenodiodes today. Over.
Can two of you?
Go ahead, Rich. And one of the questions we had for you earlier, Rich, was your cubicle quad. Have they done something at the four corners to give it strain relief so you don't get metal fatigue and it's falling apart there every year? Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I heard you said earlier I was busy, indisposed, as they say, but I did copy the net. I wanted to say this first on this question. Typically, I most amplify at 10 picofarad to 100 picofarad. We'll give him good coverage right up to 10 meters. You want something that goes down to about 8 or 10 picofarad, no more than that, at its minimum, so it'll work on 10. And he can get that capacitor fairly inexpensively from a Meritron, because a Meritron now sells parts as well as making amplifiers. You can get the capacitor that's in my AL1500, which is a 10 to 100 picofarad loading plate tuning capacitor. I think it's about $25 or $35, and that'll do them just fine. On the quad, Dick, I hope they solve the problem. I know years ago when I had the W2AU quad, they used to make quads. Let me get a drop. All right. What they did was really the worst way. They had you. They put screws, machine screws, through the spreaders, and had you wire one turn around the screw, and of course developed terrible metal fatigue. Now what Cubex is doing, and I don't know if it's any better or not, they have you pass the wire through the spreader, like passing a thread through the eye of a needle, and to keep it from shifting back and forth, they take another piece of wire, they twist it around, one turn around the spreader, just to hold it in place, and then twist it around the element wire. And I questioned Cubex. They told me, do not put any solder at that point, because if you solder it, maybe that's what this fellow did, I don't know. If you put solder, then you develop a point where it'll break. They said, do not put solder. Can I think?
Sounds like you would then create a point of stress concentration if you did. Any idea what gauge of wire, and is it stranded wire versus solid wire that's used for your actual cubicle quad elements? Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, they said 7th strand, number 14, copper.
Okay, I'll bet you the 7th strand gives it a lot more flexibility than if it was solid 14 gauge, and that also cuts down on the metal fatigue when it's being bent back and forth. It's a poor man's equivalent of Litz wire, being used on 80 meters. Very fine, whole lot of individual strands. In the case of Litz wire, though, the strands are individually insulated from each other to give you high frequency characteristic. Some of the pie-wound RF chokes used to be made out of Litz wire. I imagine there are still available transmitting type 2.5 microhenry RF chokes. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY,
K2LIW? K2KEY. You saw we were standing there at that table. The guy had all kinds of junk. He dismantled all those surplus pieces of equipment. Remember, I picked up a Dalton relay, and he had chokes laying there, and sockets, and all kinds of stuff. A whole table laid out. Boxes and boxes of that stuff were laying there. So, yeah, you look around, you'll find all this kind of stuff. But there it is. Yeah, you can, like I say, you can, like Rich just said, Meritron, yeah, and still producing amplifiers using 811. You got away from 813, like I say, there's so many around surplus, but I guess they dried up eventually. But it was a very nice tube. Boy, it was rugged. It was heavy, too. But, and the physical size of it was the same, basically, if you can picture an 811, was about the same height as an 811. So it was a really, I could say, nice tube. And the power supplies, oh, you could get those transformers for literally scrap weights. I remember buying plate transformer, 2,000 volt plate. Now, let's put it this way. You bought the whole power supply. It was a rack panel, you know, a 19-inch black rack panel. It was made by Bendix. I remember distinctly Bendix's you know, plate on the front of it. And you bought the whole power supply in Cortlandt Street. And they had them stacked up. Oh, some of them were banged up and all. You took one that was like, looked like a little, you know, like it went through something pitching around. If you bought one like that, you'd pay about $15 for the whole thing. And it came, and of course, with the 866 mercury rectifiers and a bunch of OA2s. I guess you remember the OA2s and the OB2s they used, Dick, in those days, over.
Sure do. Neon-filled voltage regulator tubes. Used those, used 811s, and my, a pair of 811s was my first transmitter. I never built a transmitter with 813, even though on a couple of occasions I've owned 813. The 813 tube had a very large carbon plate, and the plate was made out of solid carbon, therefore it could glow almost yellow without doing any damage when you really put it into high plate dissipation. The great big glass envelope on an 813, I think, was a little wider in diameter than 811. The 811 tube with a plate cap may have stood the same altitude. The 811, as I remember, had a four-pin socket. The 813, I think, had a much bigger socket. And I think the glass was larger in diameter with a carbon anode plate circuit. Carbon anode in that plate, if you remember. Back to you, Mel.
And Roger, it had a larger socket because it was a petrol. The 811 was actually a triode. Okay, very good. Yeah, I guess they start thinking back about the old amplifiers. And, oh, I'm telling you, I had, I can say, you could do it those days, so cheap. You know, put a kilowatt on the air, and those days under $100, you know, surplus, so, It was amateur radio really shined through the 40s and the 50s in those days. Everybody was home brewing, and there was so much surplus around that there was no excuse for you not to be able to put something on the air, you know, because they called it the public. And like I say, I got on the air initially with a investment of under $15. All right, shall we go on and try one more?
KB1RFY. KB1RFY, out of your name, sir. Yeah, you got bills, Jeff. I just got a quick question about rotors. A ham 4 rotor, a guy offered me one he wanted to sell. He wanted like 2.5. I don't know too much about rotors. Any suggestions? Yeah, the price on those is going up recently. I think brand new, that machine is $550. What do you think, Mel?
I just bought one. It is about $550 brand new.
Roger, it depends also on which control box. They have a digital control box for it that adds a lot of money onto it. I think they call that the Ham 5, am I correct, Rich? Over.
Hey, you're correct, Mel. But the Ham 4 with the analog meter is like 5.5, brand new.
And the actual circuit inside, Rich, you're going to find out, Rich from Connecticut, you're going to find out is not very complicated. The most expensive single part I can think of is the ring gear, and at least in the old days, that was a rather inexpensive replacement item, like $4 or so for that ring gear. So if you see it turn once in front of you, so to speak, the chances of it being defective are pretty low, and it's not a very difficult thing to maintain. Back to the news station, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, KB1IFY, Bill over in Stanford. Okay, Dick, Rich, Mel, thank you guys for the info. I was curious. I said the guy had it. I figured that if it was a steal, I'd pick it up, and then if I decide to put one up, I have it.
I've seen them a little cheaper from time to time at flea markets. I wouldn't say you've got a steal, but you're not being raked over the coals. That's what I think both Rich and Mel were saying to you. Back to you, Mel, for any further comments on that, and pick up at least one more of your mailbag.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Dick just said it's an easily serviced piece of equipment. In fact, if you do pick it up, if it's been up there a number of years, you just easily open it up and, you know, put a little more grease, a couple of fingers of grease around inside there can always help. So clean up the indicator or resistor inside, put a little lubricant on that and all, and the thing, in most cases, even if it has to have some replacement parts, it's all available. Everything is available there. And the original one, yeah, the original ham, M rotor, when it first came out, that was what they were played with that ring gear cracking, breaking. But that was later on remedied by when they came out with the steel gear. The original one was a cast gear. Okay, we go on to one more, Dick. Maybe we just jam it in. Over.
Give it a try.
Today I'm looking down here, but I can read. Oh, you gotta kick out of something. Oh, boy. All right. Oh, here's one. Okay. You talked about an experiment. Oh, this is what happened last week. You with the 100. The tower was fully up on top. Started a whole routine here, Dick. You guys talked about an experiment that you did or melted with a dipole. Please explain exactly what you did, what you found. I'm so fascinated by this experiment. I would like to see if I can repeat it. Okay, basically what I did, as I said, Dick and I have discussed it in the past. In fact, I tried to talk him into continuing this experiment. I took a dipole, a 40-meter dipole, because it was just basically convenient size for me to work with, and I put it up horizontal at 65 feet. And I said to myself, broadside to Europe, and I said, gee, I wonder if this thing is going to be really, is this the optimum? In other words, the dipole optimum sitting at 65 feet. Would I be better in some kind of a sloping type of situation? Would I be better if I dropped it vertical? So that's where the experiment came. I'm going to go drop. Okay, so what I did, I put from one support, I put have a pulley up there where I pulled it up that end. I put on the end of that dipole a sinker, a weight, and I had the spring coming across, and I pulled it into the window of the shack with nice weather. This was done during Labor Day. I was left alone that weekend, and so I had the spring, this fish cord, coming back into the window of the shack, and so when I laid out the spring, the dipole would basically start to float down towards the vertical. And I was listening to a station that was working a bit of a number of stations. He was continuously on. This is on CW, low end of 40 meters. And I was nitpicking, really, to see what exactly is happening. So what I did is hooked just to the audio output of my receiver. I put a scope I have. I took an old scope and I converted that. I changed the PRT. I put in a P7. That's a longer persistence. The 5F P7 were popular tube used in radar, World War II. You could also pick them up surplus for like a dollar a piece. And I replaced the original 5-inch tube, the one that's on old scope. And the reason for that is because of the long persistence, I actually could see the peak, you know, of the key, peaks of seeing the receiver, so I could actually get some kind of definitive measurement. Let me let it drop. And what I did is I kept going up and down, basically listening to DX stations in Europe, and seeing what actually, and I found that the dipole, basically, as I sloped it down, in fact, at one point, I found the optimum point, which is now fixed, with approximately from 65 feet down, and makes an angle of about 28 degrees with ground, and this seems to be the optimum for working DX on 40 meters, and I've had a lot of success with it. Really, honestly, everything I hear on 40 CW, usually comes back to me within the first or the second call and uses a pile-up, so there must be something to it. Now, I was trying to convince Dick to do that experiment on his tower with an 80-meter dipole, so we'll toss it back to him.
I was out there with my binoculars today with my son, Christopher, looking at this beautiful pulley up at the top of the tower, the two yellow ropes coming down to the tree. String a dipole up there would be so easy. If I wasn't so book solid with some of the work I'm doing right now, which is slowly becoming a little bit lighter, very slowly, I have the ability to make a purely vertical 80-meter dipole, raise it quite far above the ground, and tilt it at any angle from purely vertical to, I'm going to run out of property before I get it completely horizontal with one end on the ground, so to speak, but I can come close. Now, in my case, the most convenient place to do it, I would be stringing it from the tower, and the point on the ground would be almost dead south. So therefore, the dipole would be broadside to Europe. And it would really be a slanted broadside dipole to Europe. And as I slanted it, somehow I think if I could slant it to the northeast toward Europe, I'd get a little bit better performance. I know there are people over the years, let me drop, who have spoken about the sloper dipole with reverence, like that antenna would bring tears to their eyes. It worked so well. And they were so happy with it, and they couldn't understand why other people haven't done it. And by the way, if I'm smart enough to do the impedance matching, there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. I can make it one solid piece of wire, 132 feet long, and with the right kind of impedance matching device, I can feed it at the bottom. And that would be a lot easier. It wouldn't even need any feed line going up the tower. So, how many people do you know, Mel, who have successfully fed a dipole from one end, a sloper, by feeding it from the bottom? K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, I don't know of anyone. I've seen some experiments. Now, not exactly the way you laid it out just now. It would be interesting, of course, to see what happens. The point is, when you put up a dipole and you say a sloper, what is the optimum angle? Now, of course, one side's not going to fit all. I'm sure what I sloped it here at my location could be a whole different situation by your location. But I have never seen an experiment where anybody even has thought that, optimizing by a hit and miss, or you want to know an actual hands-on experiment, I should say hit and miss, but actual hands-on experiment of obtaining what is the optimum angle to set a dipole. It's not horizontal, that I proved, and it's not vertical. It's somewhere in between. Is this a viable way, or is there some other way that you can think of it? And I'll tell you about one other experiment, Dick, over.
2HWW, with a comment on slopers.
Okay, we're going to turn it over to Howie in a minute. I could run a piece of RG8U up the tower and feed it in the center with a balun and have a service loop on that RG8 or RG214 so that the service loop would stretch out as I bring the sloper away from the tower. That would be one simple way to feed it from the center. The other technique would be to build an impedance step-up device and feed it from the bottom with an antenna tuner in the shack. Now, I could also come up with a rope and pulley system on the ground so that I could remotely, by pulling on ropes, maybe even working a motor, change the slope of the dipole remotely while watching the S-meter on the receiver. Or if I'm real smart, bring the receiver out into the backyard and watch the receiver as you change the slope. I think that's close to what you were doing. There are very few people you and I know, Mel, who have the resources to build a purely vertically polarized 80-meter dipole. Since there are so few of them, it's time that somebody go do it. If you had that resource, would you do it, Howie? Would it be to HWW, K2LAW?
Well, the comment is this, Dick. Back in the 70s, 69, 70, I played around with a sloping antenna both on 10 meters and on CB, and I'll tell you, I had very good results with the antenna, like going from, let's say, on the top of my roof at an angle, like a 30 or a 40 degree slope, and feeding it in the middle. I really had great results on 15 to 20. It was a great antenna. I found that it worked very well on the, the higher bands. I couldn't tell if it was better than inverted B, but in some directions, some days, I was the king of the band, Dick.
Yeah, I've also got the ability, Mel, of not only mounting it at a sloping angle, but I can, to some degree, change the altitude above the ground. I've got an extra resource to do that. Might it would be a fun antenna. Now, I am guessing that the ideal slope angle is, again, one of these situations where it's a function of the status of the ionosphere. I'll bet you the ideal sloping angle, depending on which azimuth direction you're talking to a guy in, is an optimum angle that takes best advantage of what the ionosphere is doing that day. And it may be a little bit different some other day. If you're smart enough to hook up ropes on the ground so you can change the tilt angle and or altitude, boy, you can have a grand old time. K2KEY, KQRIW.
K2KEY, never seen any reference directly to this experiment. The only thing I've seen, which was quite an interesting experiment, and I didn't believe until I saw actually the results when I was in Houston at NASA. I visited one of the hams, took me to his piece, and you've got to see what I'm doing, okay, with antenna. And I got out of town, you know, there, of course, land is cheap at that time, especially once you get out of Houston. And he had acres of land, and he had a magnificent setup. He had four towers. He had two 100-foot towers, 512 feet separated. He had two towers that were 275 feet separated. And stretched on the top of these towers was a loop antenna, a diamond, in the shape of a diamond if you look down. Now, the two towers that had 275 feet apart had an electric winch on each one of them. And the whole idea is so he could tilt this diamond, actually tilt it, and like you just said, compensate for different conditions. And boy, he showed me when he tilted it, like for instance, we were on 20 meters when he tilted it. I couldn't believe it. Am I possible? Maybe I was hypnotized, but I can remember at least a difference of 15 to 20 dB by him just tilting the loop stick. Now, was this an aberration or whatever, but I honestly said I was flabbergasted at the time, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up Howie in a, second. I definitely believe it. When you go from cross-polarization to not polarized, on a signal, you can pick up tremendous numbers of dB. Howie, go right ahead.
Hi, K2RIW, Dick.
We're hearing you, Howie. Go ahead.
I just want to let you know that I have used slopers both on 11 meters and on 10 and on 15, and I've had very good results, but I've tied it from, let's say, from on the roof, from a wall to a bent pipe or something, you know, whatever angle it was, 30 degrees, 40 degrees, and when I was growing up, they were the cheapest antennas, but I was the king of the band. They work real well.
In Elmel, I've got one other capability. To the south, I've got clearance from trees. To the east and to the northeast, where Europe is, I'd have to go through some trees in that direction. But if I clear a couple of branches, not only could I bank a sloper in that direction, but by way of a catenary upper guy wire, so to speak, I could make a 2-3-4 element vertically polarized Yagi out of wire. That's another tempting idea. Machine's about to close down on us, 73 you all. This was TechNet number 1180 of the series that began in September 1982. See you guys next week. Be kind to each other. Back to you, Mel.
Night, everybody, and to you.
Hey, good night, Rich. Good night, Howie and Dick. And everybody have a great Easter holiday and all. Thank you for joining us. Try to get good. We'll discuss this further, Dick. It's a very interesting concept to see if we can really really see what different angles and all. I've never seen this covered, so it's something that we could really discuss. And, of course, like you say, it's doable. 73, everybody. We'll see you next week. This is K2KEY. Good night.